The Inglourious live tour continues as the Trexperts make their way across this fine country of ours to all kinds of great convention goodness. You can see us next in Trek Conderoga as we join Jonathan Frakes, Brent Spiner, and Clint Howard for some Tranya at the Star Trek tour. Darren?
It's going to be amazing, particularly because it's going to be the first time that Mark Altman visits the Star Trek original series set tour. And I'm going to be there to watch every minute of it.
And me too. Wait. Not a hologram, not an imaginary story, but real, live. You can touch me, but only if you pay extra. Don't touch me. Don't touch me. Don't look at me.
And don't try and steal his coffee.
I can't wait. And of course, Memorial Day weekend will be in Oklahoma City for the inaugural Oklahoma City show from GalaxyCon in July.
In July,
Ashley and I will be at San Diego Comic-Con. Well, Darren, tell the folks where you'll be.
I will be in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I'm going to debut a little something about Star Trek the Motion Picture.
I would go, but I can't pronounce it. Right. And then, of course, in September and August, sure, we're going to find our way to San Jose as we're reunited, and it feels so good, for the inaugural San Jose GalaxyCon. And we're looking forward to seeing a lot of you up there. It's going to be a really fun one.
That's exciting. Is that the right word?
It is exciting.
It's exciting.
It'll be the only time it takes you guys less time to get to a convention than it does me.
That's true. We can walk there in the time it takes you to get there.
Yeah. And this fall, Ashley and I will be doing Nightmare Weekend back in Richmond. I know what restaurants we won't be going to. And we bring it on all home at Columbus, Ohio, at GalaxyCon. So for more information, go to GalaxyCon.com, ComicCon.org, and StarTrekTour.com. And you can see us at one or all of these amazing conventions. And we can't wait to see you there. Always great to see our listeners join the expedition. So until then, keep on trekking ingloriously, of course, all the way to GalaxyCon, Star Trek Tour, and Comic-Con.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, this is Mark A. Altman.
And this is Darren Doctorman.
And this is Ashley Miller.
And we are the Inglourious
Trexperts. Hey, I like that. We did that in sync. Like, that was good. Maybe, Ashley, you could join us when we do it.
Okay.
And we are the Inglourious Trexperts.
Okay. Wow. Well, that was a bit of a clash.
Anyway, people are either going to be thrilled or not, because we're back to talk about Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, to honor, sort of, the June 1st, 1984 release. It's 40 years since Star Trek III came out in theaters.
All that they've loved, all that they've stood for, will now be put to the test.
The word, sir, the word is no. I am therefore going anyway.
Join us on this, the final voyage of the Starship Enterprise. Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, rated PG. Starts today at a theater near you.
And if you think we've said it all, about Star Trek III when we had Kevin Feige and Terry Metalis and Steve Asbell here to talk about it for our 300th episode. You are wrong. You are wrong. Incorrect, sir. Because we have good friend of the podcast, the former unit publicist of Star Trek III, Eddie Egan, who later, of course, became head of marketing for Fox and Universal Pictures. He really a legend in publicity and promotion at the studios. But back early in his career, he was the unit publicist on the Star Trek films. He has some great stories about the making of this. I was going to say of this classic Star Trek film. Yes, it's a classic because it featured the classic Star Trek.
Because it's older than 25 years.
Look, and I know some of you are thinking, oh, if they're going to be mean about Star Trek III, I'm not going to listen. Well, guess what? You should, because there's so much we learned about this film from Eddie that you are not going to be disappointed.
And for a change, the meanness isn't coming from us.
It's so wild. I know. He was there. And I got to tell you, we've talked to a few people about Star Trek III recently, like from production, like who worked on it. Mm-hmm. And I hate to tell you this, they're more on our side than they're on your side. Like there is not a lot of love from people who worked on Star Trek III for Star Trek III. I'm just telling you. Maybe at the conventions they tell you they loved it, but the truth, not so much. Which again,
you'll find out even from our beloved Dr. McCoy himself.
That's right. But we do not spend an hour and a half just gigantic steamer on Star Trek III.
I want to make that caveat again. Listen, you know, we have a lot of fun with this whole Star Trek III thing. We don't hate Star Trek III. It frustrates us that it's not a better movie.
We like Star Trek III.
We really do. That sagging old rust bucket.
We're not saying Star Trek III is garbage.
We're saying it should be hauled away as garbage. Okay, so you're not helping me make my point here, guys. I'm saying that we have a lot of respect and love and admiration.
And that's when you hit him.
For Star Trek III. And we want to understand why things went right and why things didn't, why things work on a starship and why things don't. And so, again, this is the 40th anniversary. This is a great chance for us to do these deeper dives into Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. And I think this is a truly deep dive with someone who was there and has amazing stories. So I know you're anxious to hear what he has to say. So are we. So without any further ado, let's welcome Eddie Egan to the podcast.
Hey, this is Terry Farrell of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and I'm here to invite you to join me and the Inglorious Trekspurts as we go on the ultimate road trek, visiting the most iconic Star Trek locations ever filmed. We'll share fun facts about scenes that were filmed there, their incredible Hollywood histories. We may even fight a Gorn or two along the way. We have many special guests from Star Trek movies and series. You can reserve your copy of this epic new documentary on Blu-ray or DVD, along with a gaggle of intergalactic rewards, such as Ernie, the pet Vasquez rock, limited edition collector pins, cool sci-fi swag, autographs, of course, and so much more by going to makethetrek.com and supporting us as we boldly go to the greatest Star Trek locations ever filmed. Go to makethetrek.com and let's see what's out there. Engage.
Hey, it's me, Todd Stashwick. You know me as Captain Liam Shaw of the Starship Titan, but I am coming at you as a dungeon master right now. And I want you to dig in on our new Progcore Fantasy Dark Age of Fear Kickstarter project coming at the end of May. It is going to be an album, an animation, a book, so many things. If you're into dark fantasy and that late 70s, early 80s vibe, go to Progcore Fantasy, that's progcore.com. That's progcore ProgCoreFantasy.com, ProgCoreFantasy.com, and sign up for some wonder, mystery, and danger.
Adventure was just the beginning.
Indy! It's me, Indiana Jones.
Dear Dad, I've joined the Mexican Revolution. Sorry about high school.
I'm Peter Hompstrom.
And I'm Daniel Noah. Together, we host a new podcast called The Young Indie Chroniclers, where we explore the behind-the-scenes stories of a forgotten treasure from the career of George Lucas and the Indiana Jones franchise, the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles television series.
Kept thinking about what was Indiana Jones like as a young man. I came up with this idea of him seeing the world through the eyes of a soldier and a secret agent.
Over the course of our podcast, we're going to talk to a whole host of very talented people who either worked on this show or were there from the beginning.
We were able to shoot it on location in the real places where these events took place.
Oh, make it up as you go. Oh boy, that's great advice.
We hired some of the best European directors, a whole host of very, very talented people.
It was a show that was both a proving ground for the technology used in the Star Wars prequels, and now in every film made in Hollywood and the rest of the world, and a continuation of one of the most successful franchises of all time.
Young Indy had been a labor of love. It sort of combined a lot of his own loves, which is storytelling and filmmaking and history.
They say we can't do a show on Picasso because nobody knows who Picasso is. And then he'd throw that note in the fire. I think at one point we did a ritual burning of the note.
I was always interested in what George Lucas would come up with because he just doesn't think the way a lot of other people do.
He hired movie directors. He wanted to have the scope. It was like movies, little movies.
We're just having a conversation. There's two creative people.
Yeah, there are two creative people here. George is 1.98 of the two, and I'm 0.02.
It is Lucas's fingerprint all the way through.
ABC was frustrated because they had thought, okay, this is Indiana Jones. We're going to get an action adventure every week. Well, sometimes it was a war story. Sometimes it was a musical. Sometimes it was a love story.
I think it's a sort of neglected little masterpiece of television.
Join us to uncover the mystery of the Young Indiana Jones franchise, the highs, the lows, and the question of what ultimately kept the series from becoming a success.
On the Young Indie Chroniclers, every other Thursday, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, things can't always be the way you want them to be.
But sometimes they are.
And here we are with Eddie Egan once again making his triumphant return to the show. Eddie, we are so happy to have you back. It's always fascinating, and there's always new information to be gleaned. You drop these pearls, and we're like, what? It's like when you said, you know, they were developing a prequel to Star Trek II.
Yeah.
In the aftermath of Wrath of Khan, and we were all like, what? Now everyone knows about it, but you were the one who started that ball rolling. Maybe that's a good place to start.
I didn't mean to.
You didn't mean to. I mean, it's so interesting that that was not something that was widely known for a long time. And I think what's crazy is that it was John Hughes of The Breakfast Club and Ferris Bueller, you know, because he had his deal with Paramount, that and Nathan Hayes at the time, right? That was developing that. What do you remember about that? Because that could have been Star Trek III.
It wasn't intended. I mean, it was just about making the most of the impact that Montalban had, that the character had, and it kicked around for a long time, but it was being developed in the same way that Star Trek II and III were, by the TV division. It was being supervised by the TV division of Paramount with like some oversight from the theatrical department. But it was just about what happened after they got deposited there and, you know, a society developed.
Could you imagine, had John Hughes, had this actually been produced, that he would have been
known for Star Trek instead of going on to do all those great teen comedies. I mean, instead of Weird Science, maybe we would have had, you know, another
Weird Star Trek.
Weird Star Trek, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. They used him for a lot of things. He was like the in-house pinch hitter for writing. In those days, he would come in and solve story issues on a lot of movies he's not credited on.
Every studio, you know, has a couple of these guys that they go to.
Yeah.
You know, the Simon Kinbergs of the era, obviously. Yes. And it's interesting that John Hughes was that guy because, of course, he's best known for comedies, and yet he was really facile. I mean, he could write drama, he could write romance, he could do it all.
Yeah.
And for Paramount, he was that guy. So let's talk about Star Trek III. So it's the aftermath of Wrath of Khan. Has this really successful opening, the biggest opening in Paramount history, a three-day weekend. Star Trek III immediately, kind of shortly thereafter, goes into development. Do you remember? I mean, again, we're asking you about something that happened 40 years, you know, over 40 years ago. But do you remember what it was like and you know, at what point you sort of got brought in to write Hurd on Star Trek III as the unit publicist?
I had to do Star Trek II. I actually had to quit my actual job at Paramount because I had to join the union to come out to LA. And then they kept me on it through release. But then I rejoined Paramount, and there had been talk a month prior to the film's opening that this might not be the end. By that time, Leonard was fully invested in it. He couldn't believe how well it had turned out and what the reaction to it was like. So there had been various conversations within the company about, all right, if we're going to do this, we have to do it quickly. And it really did come together quickly. I mean, I was 23 at the time, I think. When I came back to New York, I moved in again with my parents. And I came home one night, and there was, you know, a little piece of paper in the kitchen and my father's handwriting. And it said Leonard Nimoy called 213-468, whatever his extension was. And my mother told me that my father made him spell his last name.
Good.
Yes. When he took the message. So anyway, I called him back the next morning, and he says, should we do it again? I said, well, I can be as involved as you need me to be, but I have to talk to my bosses and everything, because I'll make those calls. Yeah. So, you know, we had a good relationship. He attributes far more to me than I was responsible for. Like, I'm not being overly modest, because, you know, there was a whole machine of people who had a good movie to work with, good materials, and a lot of luck in terms of its execution and its timing. But he was particularly struck by how protective I was of him during the production of Star Trek II. So he, you know, in this new role, he wanted me involved. So I didn't go out to, I wasn't in LA the whole time while it was shooting, but I was very, very much involved in the hiring of the people who were on set and again, dealing with the fan community.
How would you characterize his evolution? Because you talk about how he was, you know, surprised that well, Star Trek II came out. Like, you know, going into Star Trek II post motion picture, and his feelings about, you know, the various stories, some of which have been mythologized about, you know, I want to be killed, and, you know, ultimately sort of coming to terms with the fact that, like, wow, this was a good experience. And, you know, working with Nick, and then obviously the release, and how the, you know, the reviews were so positive. Like, what was Nimoy's emotional, ironically, arc from, you know, through this process, if you recall.
I remember the first time I spoke to him while Star Trek II was shooting. He was very anxious to meet me. I got, you know, like when he got, I don't think he shot the first day. No, he did shoot the first day. And then he was off for a bit and then he came back. But when he came back, his assistant, Teresa, had arranged a meeting with me. And he was quite adversarial when I first met him, like about the subject of, he just felt like that he and the other actors got a bad rap for what was the chaotic production and, in most people's view, mixed result of the first movie. And he said, I just want to know that you'll, you know, there's a very controversial aspect to this movie, so I want to know that you'll be sensitive and work with me and protect me. And I said, sure, you know. So so we had a very, very good, trusting relationship then for many years.
And he didn't care that you were so young either.
No, he didn't.
Right. That's great. You know, that's great that he was willing to hand this, because there's probably no more Star Trek picture that it was more important to have the publicity and marketing in the hands of the right people than Star Trek II, because it was so sensitive with the death of Spock. And, you know, and again, we are all huge fans of the motion picture. So we're not in any way besmirching the motion picture. We're all huge fans. We know that. But, you know, the perception of Star Trek, the motion picture at the time, was largely negative, you know, among the cast and among the press.
And most of that came from Leonard.
Studio. And right, most of that came from Leonard. But mostly because they didn't listen to him.
Yeah.
And he had to be, you know, he had to be massaged into the picture, whether that was simply with money or with other things. You know, so he felt like maybe I made a mistake, you know, so. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he showed up. He was happy. He had a great time on the show.
Why was that? Is he liked the script? Is he like Nick? He liked Tarv?
He liked all of it. He was just happy. He was just into it. He felt like the characters were clicking. The pace was good. Like, you know, he would talk endlessly about how days would go by on the first movie and nothing got done. And, you know, he was the only one who had to come in at 4:30 in the morning. So he was happy with the, you know, the breakneck pace of the movie that was being supervised by the TV division. So,
because it was being shot like TV, because even though it was never going to be a TV movie, as some people mistakenly said, it was produced under the aegis of the TV division.
Correct. Yeah. It was always going to be released as a feature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, before we talk too much about Star Trek III, you said something that I just found so fascinating. You know, obviously Gary Nardino, who became a producer on Star Trek III, was head of the TV division when Star Trek II was being made, where he developed like a lot of these relationships with Harv and all these people. And you said that had Star Trek II not worked, there was talk of having Kirstie Alley and Merritt Buttrick in a TV spinoff. And that's why the TV division was involved in casting them.
Gary Nardino was kind of obsessed with Merritt Buttrick as a, like just as an actor, the way he looked. You know, he looks like a good looking lead for a TV series. He was very, very focused on Merritt, but, you know, the role is what it was.
Did Nick have any say in that, or was that strictly a TV division?
Oh, all of that is TV decision, you know. I mean, you know, no creative people ever like to hear this, but, you know, it's the studio's property.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Which is wild, because I mean, I think at least among us, we feel Merritt was probably one of the less effective parts of two and three, you know, obviously he's great in Square Pegs. He's a wonderful actor, but he didn't feel like William Shatner's son.
No.
You know, or Kirk's son.
No.
So it's so interesting. I mean, yeah. Like I said, I'm always amazed that here we are all these years later and we're still finding out things about this thing that we love. So, you said it came together very quickly again under the aegis of the TV division. Gary Nardino was a producer with Harve Bennett. What were your impressions of Harve and Gary and these guys?
Well, Gary was a scary guy. I mean, he was, I don't think he smoked, but he literally, your impression of him, he was chomping on a cigar all the time. Like he was like an old school, you know, TV executive that just, you know, ran through a day and made decisions quickly and constantly and had a lot of irons in the fire. And at that time there was a bit of a rivalry for the future of syndication and the possibility of a fourth network and, you know, that stuff that had been kicking around for years. And I think he welcomed the success of the second movie as perhaps a way into a business he could establish on his own, apart from the ambitions of people like Lucy Salhaney, who ran the TV service, eventually the fourth network. He wasn't very present during the shooting of either movie. He's not someone who came to the set very often, or if he did, it was with, you know, like other TV producer golfing buddies. But he was a very, very colorful man, a big man in all senses, a big man. Yeah.
Yeah. Because he was no longer an executive by the third movie. He was now the producer on it. What was your take on Harve?
Well, you know, Harve and Bob Salin had that rivalry / fallout as the film was being released, when they both smelled, you know,
success
or blood in the water or victory you know, Harve learned the wrong way that in the movie business as opposed to the TV business, the executive producer is not the person who people think of as the grand poobah.
Right.
You know, as you guys know, in the TV business, an executive producer is often a line producer or a showrunner or whatever they call them now. So there was a, you know, Harve's ego really came to the fore when the picture was being released. And he wanted a lot of attention. He wanted a lot of credit, you know, and, you know, he deserved a lot of credit. He shepherded it along. But the thing with him and Bob just came to loggerheads and, you know, they were barely cordial to each other toward the end.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you feel the absence of Bob Salin on Star Trek III?
Well, I think it's evident if you watch Star Trek III. You know, they had basically the same amount of money adjusted for inflation.
Yeah, $16 million versus, what, $13 million, I think?
Yeah, something like that. And it just looks really, really cheap. It looks cheap in every way, you know. I think Bob, because he had come out of commercials, knew how to work in small spaces and make them look bigger. And, you know, instead of like in Star Trek III, a lot of the show is bathed in like single color lights and it doesn't have a lot of detail. It has that flat TV lighting look. And some of that is, you know, the number of days you're allotted and all of that. And some of it is what it lacked was someone on the show who was looking to, instead of just getting, you know, days accomplished and shot can, a look and a feel that I think is lacking in three because of there was no Bob. I mean,
and to be fair, Leonard was inexperienced.
Yes, and, yeah, and also Leonard
he needed a Bob.
Leonard, by the way, you know, like got paid like nothing to do this. Like, you know, he got, I think he got scale for the acting, and he did first time DGA scale for whatever they paid directors then. I mean, he made up for it, but.
Well, he has two lines in the movie.
Yeah. but yeah, so there wasn't someone in that role like who would just come in and say, hey, you know, that you know, the thing that Bob brought was a kind of precision and a thoughtfulness in a very businessman like way, no ego, spoke well to all departments, and Harv by that time, especially because he wrote it, if you call some of it writing, respectfully.
Wow.
Oh, come on.
I just want everybody to realize I didn't say a darn thing.
You're preaching to the choir.
No, I watched, I zipped through it last night, and there's a scene in the beginning during Shatner's soliloquy when the movie opens, and there's so much odd phrasing in the movie. Something about the David is about the planet Genesis, which he helped create.
Right.
Like, who talks
your life
about
has
that?
Not stood for intellectual chaos.
No, absolutely not, Jim. You're my best officer. But I am Commander Starfleet, so I don't break rules.
Don't quote rules to me. I'm talking about loyalty and sacrifice. One man who's died for us. Another with deep emotional problems.
Now, wait a minute. This business about Spock and McCoy. Honestly, I never understood Vulcan mysticism.
You don't have to believe. I'm not even sure that I believe. But if there's even a chance that Spock has an eternal soul, then it's my responsibility.
Yours?
As surely as if it were my very own. Give me back the Enterprise. With Scotty's help, I can...
No, Jim. The Enterprise would never stand the pounding, and you know it.
Then I'll find a ship. I'll hire a ship.
Out of the question, my friend. The Council has ordered that no one but the science team goes to Genesis. Jim, your life and your career stand for rationality, not for intellectual chaos. Keep up this emotional behavior, and you'll lose everything. You'll destroy yourself. Do you understand me, Jim?
I hear you. I had to try.
Of course.
Thanks for the drink.
Anytime.
Yeah, there's a whole, yeah.
Well, it's like his whole opening monologue is previously on Star Trek.
Yes. Yeah. So, anyway. But he was... he was looking to move out of the TV business and become a film producer at that point. And he had his eye on other things, and the show kind of ran itself with the, you know, the UPM and Ralph Winter and the other key people. But I do think a lot of the way it looks, especially, was due to Bob not being there.
You mentioned how fast it came about, how fast 3 came about. Mm. It's interesting how faster it would have been had the heads of the studio realized that Leonard actually wanted to be in Star Trek now. Leonard said that he was waiting around for a couple months for them to get his contract together. And because Michael Eisner thought that he had in his contract that he wanted Spock to die for 2. The contract is right there in your building. Just look at it. It's not there.
People think of, you know, studio executives are not immune to the effects of media reports.
Yeah.
So at some point he had heard it so often that it became part of how he saw the situation, even though obviously he was in the situation and could have, as Leonard said, just, hey, call business affairs.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You know what I can't stop thinking about now that we're talking about Bob Salen and the kinds of creative choices and the producerial decisions that he would have made? That the thing that I just can't get out of my head now is, would he have saved Walter Koenig from
the Peter Pan collar?
Yeah. I have to imagine he would. I have to imagine he would.
You think someone would have.
Yeah.
It's just...
We've had Walter tell about that. And the reason that it's still there in those scenes is because Walter didn't know that he could actually speak up about it.
Yeah.
And he was just going along with the flow.
And they'd already shot the master by the time it came up to broom it.
Yeah, yeah. It was pretty bad. I remember like when I first saw it, I think I first saw it in stills. Mm. And I thought it was, thing they put around.
To protect from the makeup.
The makeup thing, the makeup.
Right.
And I remember calling the guy who was on the show itself. I said, we should kill all these. These are, and he goes, no, that's the costume. You know, some of them got out. I mean, it was unavoidable, like for certain things, but oof. Yeah.
That is so funny. When did you hear that Leonard was directing this one? And what was your personal feeling when you heard? Was it in that phone call or had it already?
It had already been established. It was just about the schedule then and when everyone was available. Because I know a few of the actors, Nichelle especially, had some obligations that she couldn't get out of for something else. Mm-hmm. Which I think partly explains why she's in the movie so little.
Oh, that's interesting.
During that whole stretch. Mm-hmm. It came together like in the company pretty quickly that he was going to direct it. But yeah, so I knew for a while. I forget when it started shooting, in the fall, I think. October maybe.
Yeah, I think it was like the fall.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was not, it didn't have a long shooting schedule, obviously, shoot all on the lot.
Yeah. Well, except for one night.
One day, right. One night at Occidental College.
Yes.
One long night.
One wind.
That sounds like the title of a coming of age movie. One long night at Occidental
very
College.
Very windy. Very, very windy.
Is that why do you think that all that footage, the epic stuff was lost? Because they shot.
Well, it wasn't epic. I mean, why go to a college and, you know, again, narrow yourself into a specific place and to avoid certain buildings and streetlights and all of that. And it just made no sense. If they had to go outdoor somewhere, make use of the outdoor location. But it was really windy. So there's that reflecting pool and it was always like whipping up and, you know, Bob Fletcher loved a robe, so everyone's wearing robes and they're all like, you know.
Well, some of them are very diaphanous. I'm amazed at some of the stills that got out is how revealing they are.
The Vestal Virgins. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they didn't make the cut. They didn't make the movie.
No. There was some circumstance with very little pomp in the Vulcan scene.
Well, it's a search for pomp.
So, it's interesting because in Star Trek II, you had one thing you had to protect, the whole death of Spock, which got out thanks to Gene, right? So the question is, on three, you had to protect the Enterprise dying. Do they find Spock? A lot of there's even more to sort of protect. And then you get to completely undermined by the marketing, which is not you, the trailer cutters, who the final version of the Enterprise, right? Voyage of the Enterprise, where they reveal in the trailer.
I'm one of those people who don't believe that using the best joke or suggesting a major plot point in a trailer diminishes interest in a movie. I mean, I've spent a lot of years listening to and reading a lot of research. People have two complaints about trailers. They show everything. They're not showing me enough.
Right.
So there's, you know, I don't think, you know, there was still an ambition of it, of these movies trying to break beyond what had been established as the, you know, the super fan, ardent followers of the franchise. And showing the Enterprise saucer burning might provoke some interest in... Mm-hmm. And also, it just suggested stakes. I mean, whether Spock returned or not was something we were always just like coy about. Like, but, you know, like, they're not going to find him. Of course, he's coming back. But we took great precaution to, like, you know, all the stills of that sequence were never developed until like the week of opening. The one sheet, I mean, the call sheet, there were things on the call sheets that obfuscated the fact that he was in the movie at all. But anyway, I lost my train of thought there. Sorry.
No, we're just talking about, like, you know, obviously Spock dying was the secret of the first, of the second film.
Yes.
And the third film, you had these other quote unquote secrets to protect. But like you said, you know, the search for Spock is the title of the movie. It's hard to hide the fact that they're going to find him. You know, nor do you really want to, because it's like, what are you going to do? The audience is going to be not satisfied. Like, yeah, they don't find him. They couldn't find him.
He's always the last place you look, honestly.
Yeah.
Like,
he's under the couch. So it's like not happening.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of the publicity, did the playbook change at all from Star Trek II? Because... was there more interest, less interest? I mean, did you still had all the, obviously, Starlog and the local tabloids and, you know, fantastic films.
Yeah,
and
no, I mean, you know, part of that is you always super serve those, that community, that media, that fandom. But there were strategic things we did, you know, with Leonard, especially, during the movie, or there was time to come out during the release of the movie. Very little press on the set, mostly to observe, so that they could do interviews with Leonard and increasingly Harv. It was very hard to get Harv any notable publicity, because everyone wanted to talk
to
Leonard.
Leonard, right.
Yeah.
But Harv wanted
or Bill, who they wanted to get his take on being directed by Leonard. So
was that a sensitive subject? I mean, for Bill at the time, you know, Leonard directing?
I think it was. I don't know that he ever expressed it very much, but he was not in as good a mood on the third movie as he was on the second. He was also very busy. I think he was still shooting Hooker.
T.J. Hooker, yeah. Right. Yeah. So
yeah.
He had a tight window for this because of his T.J. Hooker
and
schedule.
And he had a lot of, and there were some split days where he was like, you know, they were working him.
He was Kirk in the morning, Hooker at night.
Yeah.
That sounds like a movie.
That's right.
Angel. Yeah, Captain by day, Hooker by night.
Yeah.
The starship won't pay for itself.
Yeah. But no, that's you know, that's interesting. Of course, he did have time to save the studio from burning down.
Yes, indeed. I assume everyone has we've talked about that before, and everyone knows there was a fire on the
space.
That began on a soundstage, I don't think it was on the Star Trek soundstage. It was on one of the adjoining ones in an electrical panel, and it got to the stage where the Genesis planet was. Yeah, so there was a lot of media attention to Bill with a fire hose spraying down.
A garden hose.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Defending the stage.
Yeah, so.
Single-handedly.
One only has to think about, really, they're going to let an actor engage in an active fire?
Yeah.
You know,
what I love about that, though, Eddie? It harkens back to the old studio days.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's such a throwback to, you know, Clark Gable saved America, you know, and just all these great, you know, where they would
and
do.
And by the way, you know, it was completely Shatner's idea.
Has to be first one in through the door.
Yep. Yeah.
That's so great. I just love it. Even back then when it was on Entertainment Tonight, it was like, well, this is, you know, he's the captain of Battle Network Stories. Of course he was able to save the studio with the fire hose.
Yeah.
He can do it all.
Yeah.
No, you know, and it's funny though, because recently, you know, we spent some time with him and interviewed him, and he brings up the story again. And I was just like, how do you stop him from saying, you know, and then I say, you know, I was there putting out the fire, and it's like, okay.
Yeah.
We love you, but okay. So,
no, I know we've talked about this before, but, you know, these people tell these stories so often, they become false memories.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think he believes it. I think they all do.
I'm convinced he believes it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and that's fine. You know,
that's how they make their living. I mean, you know, they tell these stories.
Right. Well, because the made up stories are more interesting than the real stories in many cases.
George Takei still believes that he would have had a better career had he been promoted earlier.
Yeah.
He believes he's an actual captain.
If he had been captain earlier.
Yeah,
let me ask you this. Look, obviously that set, the Genesis Planet, is not entirely effective. It's a throwback to, you know, a different era of filmmaking. What was your feeling when you were on it, like as a set, when you saw it? Was it more impressive in person? Oh no! I'm sorry.
You know, my first. You read about it so much, like you see production sketches and you hear the ambition. And then I remember the first time I saw it, it was mostly dressed at that point. It reminded me so much of that sad little set from Star Trek II, the little
egg bubble. The Genesis Cave bowl.
Yeah. It said, well, it looks like a logical extension of that. You know, they went to the greenery department and brought in a lot of stuff and wind machines and, you know, I think there are some shots where it works better than others, but again, that just, you know, they were just choices made in the way the movie was shot, and there was so much that could be controlled.
It's fine for a Columbo episode.
Taking place on a soundstage.
Yeah. One more question, sir. Did you use proto-matter in the Genesis Matrix?
Okay, which brings us to another thing that you kind of, I mean, obviously this was more for the inside baseball crowd, for the fans, but what happened to Kirstie Alley was the stuff that people wanted to know. And how difficult was it for you to sort of say, okay, we have a new Savick, and address that with people who were asking?
Hardly anyone was asking, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I mean, her ascendancy, I forget when she started Cheers.
It was a couple of years later, but she wasn't like Masquerade for, you know.
Right. Oh, right. And then she was in Runaway.
School,
Tom
Runaway, yeah.
Yeah. So
plus boys of a certain age who grew up at that time had an affinity for Kirstie Alley that they did not have for Robin.
She changed her hair.
At that time.
She did change her hair. Yes. it wasn't something that came up a lot, to be honest, because it didn't coincide with when she really came into the consciousness of more people.
Sure, so, sure.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. No, that's,
I mean, Christopher Lloyd, on the other hand, was, you know, like that was a big question, like that, wait, he's a villain?
Right.
He's an alien?
Because everyone knew him as Reverend Jim in the yes. TV show.
And Cassie. Again, that was partly a Nardino thing, you know? And, you know, they got him for, you know, a lot of this is just how much they had to pay people. You know, they always have these amazing ambitions.
Tom Hanks. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, they might have been able to get Tom Hanks then.
At that point, but it's like, yeah. Tom Hanks is Zefram Cochrane. Yeah. It's always, yeah. Well, yeah. Eddie Murphy.
Yes. Yeah. I'm sorry. What were we talking about?
Chris Lloyd.
Chris Lloyd.
Yeah, cast. Yeah. That was a subject of curiosity for a lot of people, and remains a subject of curiosity to me. I'm not sure what, you know, just an odd choice, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we would agree. But then, you know, it's so funny. This is what makes horse racing, I guess, because there are people that absolutely adore him in that role, and he's their favorite Klingon, right? Whereas to us, it's all unfathomable.
Yeah.
That, you know, people think this is this brilliant tour de force performance and is their favorite performance of a Klingon ever, when we're all like mystified, like this yeah. hammy, over the top kind, I mean, performance. You know, you go back and you look at, you know, what John Colicos was doing in, you know, the original series, or Michael and Sarah, and then you see Christopher Lloyd just hamming it up, and I just, you know,
well, there's a lot of ham in the movie. I mean,
it's not kosher.
Almost every bit part is kind of a howler.
Yeah.
Like that ship that they're,
the Grissom.
Yeah.
Captain of the Grissom.
Like everyone on that ship is terrible. You know,
but Leonard cast his friends. That's the problem. And all the small parts, he cast his friends so they would get their SAG,
insurance.
Insurance. And they're all awful. It's amazing. Just every supporting, day player in that movie is awful. But that's the only place he had the power, because on Star Trek III, he had no power.
Yeah.
You know, he always said of Star Trek IV, the training wheels are off now after the success of Star Trek III. But they were really worried, like, could he actually direct a major motion picture?
Yeah. He should have paid a little more attention to that. I'm not sure why.
Well, I'm sure he was taken up in the whole idea of it, and the joy of finally being recognized and being, put up on some sort of a pedestal. And being in charge for the first time.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember the woman who plays the cocktail waitress.
Oh. Right.
In the bar.
Yeah. That's not your regular poison. Yeah.
She's with the lights on her.
She's Dean Cain's mother.
Really?
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And obviously Dean Cain, I don't think was Dean Cain then, but his father, her husband, was the director Christopher Cain, who directed like Young Guns, and somehow she was a friend of somebody. I forget whether she was Harv's friend or Nardino's friend or Leonard's friend. So that's how she ended up in it.
Are you saying that Hollywood is full of nepotism?
Oh my God.
It's difficult to fathom.
Yeah. It's amazing, because at least when, you know, Nick Meyer puts James Horner in the movie, he doesn't give him lines.
Right. He runs. Right. Yes. Yeah.
That's such a huge problem with Star Trek III. It's just like, I mean, we talk about it like, you know, Robert Hooks and, you know, Admiral Morrow, and just, you know, the guy who's the on the Grissom, and the Captain Esteban, yeah. And then the cargo ship guy.
Yeah.
The cargo ship, which is a bunch of boxes on the side of a soundstage.
There's some netting also.
There's some netting.
I mean, it isn't even a net. It's just boxes with a net over it.
They made good use of that $50 set budget.
Yes.
But yeah. ILM was somebody you were able to get some good articles on. And there were some great stills. I remember that press kit. there were great stills for the visual effects, you know, space dock and of the Enterprise and, you know, some really gorgeous. And of course, that's still that to this day you see everywhere. The bird of prey squaring off with the Enterprise.
Yes. Yeah.
How do you pick, you know, when you go through and decide what you're going
to
release?
Actually, that's an interesting question. They have to, it's not a frame grab. They actually have to produce it. I'm sure Darren knows this. You actually have to have it commissioned and produced and lit in a way for a still. So there couldn't be that many of them because they were expensive.
And they were busy trying to finish the movie.
Yeah. Although, like, they handed it to another team. There was a team that produced still photography at ILM. I forget the name of the guy. Terry Chostner.
Yeah. Terry Chostner.
I don't know where I just pulled that out of.
Wow. I'm impressed with both of you, I have to say.
I think I had come to know him on Dragon Slayer, which was a Paramount release in the U.S. It was Disney overseas, but I think that's where I first became familiar with that process.
So it's your fault that movie bombed.
No.
We all love Dragon Slayer.
Yeah. And of course, footage from Dragon Slayer is in Star Trek III.
Wait a second. Come back.
Where?
What footage from Dragon Slayer is in Star Trek III?
The clouds.
Oh, wow. The clouds, right? When Genesis is transforming, those are all clouds.
Isn't it in the opening titles when the flight?
Right. What would be the drone shot today?
Those are plates from Dragon Slayer.
Wow.
We learned something new.
I love every time you're on because we always get something that we didn't know before, and here we are. That's awesome.
Yeah. They look awesome.
They look great. Yeah.
That's one of the longest opening title sequences in a movie, I think. It's so long. There was a lot of to-do about Dame Judith Anderson.
Right.
I think she shot for one day
at Occidental.
Yeah. No, she wasn't at Occidental.
She wasn't.
On stage with the big
girl. Only on stage. Forks. Yeah.
Okay.
And not all of what you think is her is her. Like anything from the back is not her. She was there very, very briefly.
But it was such a big get.
Right.
I guess. Yeah.
The star of Rebecca.
But
already it was 50 years later.
Yeah.
But to be fair, she is on the Taco Bell glass.
She is, you know, I that's one of my proudest accomplishments of my career is that I met with the people from Pepsi. I think it was Pepsi at that time on Taco Bell. And they had said, well, we need four glasses. And I went away with a little assignment and I wrote a memo and sent it to them the next day. And that became Krug and Falterpan and, what was
Enterprise destroyed?
Enterprise destroyed, yes.
Head for Taco Bell at warp speed and start collecting Star Trek 3 glasses. Beam home Spock. Klingon treachery. The secret of Falterpan. And fate of the Enterprise. Star Trek 3 glasses. Only at
Taco Bell. It's just me.
And buy this week's glass, Lord Krug, for just 69 cents with the purchase of a large or medium soft drink at regular price.
They weren't coming out till you know,
after the movie came out.
Yeah. It's like Lord Krug, and the last one was Spock. Yeah.
Yes.
And it's almost a haiku.
And the phases of Spock.
Right.
I think it was the progression of the trials of the young men.
Yeah. All the other Spock actors.
The thing that really disappointed me when I saw the actual glasses is they put a hyphen in between Lord and Krug.
Grammar Nazi.
His mother's name was Lord and his dad's name was Krug.
I put that deal together, but I couldn't stop them from mispunctuating and mishyphenating it. Now if it would happen, they'd pull them out of circulation.
To be fair, those are just about the best glasses ever offered for a tie-in.
They were serious.
They're great.
Glasses.
I still have mine. I still use them almost every day.
With that,
they're amazing.
Circular, like that.
Plastic glass that McCoy had in the bar.
Yeah.
They're great.
Yeah. What I love about it is discover the secret of the Falthor Pan ritual.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's like a commercial for 8-year-olds. It's so funny. Yeah. I love that you take pride in that, Eddie. That's why we love you. Like, you have genuine pride for having come up with these something glasses.
Some factory in China made them, and, you know. And Darren, I wouldn't drink out of them, but.
Yeah, I was just going to say,
as long as you don't lick the outside with the lead paint, you're good. Yeah, besides, the McDonald glasses are way more lead filled than.
But you're not supposed to eat them.
He only drinks his Tranya out of them. Now, as the publicist on these movies, so, you know, one was McDonald's, the first Happy Meal.
Yeah.
Two was Burger King. And three was Taco Bell. Can you tell us anything else about the fast food promotions?
I don't remember Burger King.
Yeah, Star Trek II was Burger King.
It was?
Wasn't it, Darren? Please back me up on this.
I don't remember that.
Oh, shoot. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't remember any tie-ins on Star Trek.
I
thought there was, but I could be wrong.
All because of Gene Roddenberry sabotaging.
And then you had the marshmallows on Star Trek V, but that was after your time.
Yeah, that was after
mercifully.
I was on the lot with Darren on the Abyss.
Right, because you were at Fox then.
Yeah.
People don't realize you were a huge muckety muck when you left. I mean, you started as a in the business really young. I actually told, we were watching Superman. I told my son your story about being on the set during the blackout when they were filming at the Daily Planet, which he thought was a great story. But you were like 12 years old when you were working. You're older than that. I know.
How old was I?
I'm trying to make you 20, seem younger by lying.
It doesn't. 19 I was.
Okay. But I mean, you went on from doing all these Star Trek movies, which you love to, to run like Fox and Universe. I mean, you're huge, but yet you still come back and are happy to talk about Star Trek, which I find amazing.
Well, this is nice company.
Oh,
just get to know us a little better.
I may have told you this before, but Star Trek III was my first time going to a studio screening. In Chicago? No, this was, I lived in Chicago, and there was a radio station tie-in that they had that you could win tickets to. And I went to one in downtown Chicago, and it was hosted by the son of Sven Gulli, Rich Coes. And this was a big deal. And, I was so excited to see this movie. And at the time, I wasn't disappointed, but it was, year after year.
Yeah. By the way, I know we with affection pick it apart.
Of course. Because we
tested,
want it to be better.
They tested that movie a good number of times and in very primitive form, like black and white slugs, storyboards. Mm-hmm. And it tested through the roof. Like, most of the tests were in Manhattan in the basement of the Gulf and Western building, which is now the Trump
International
Tower. There was the Paramount Theater there. And almost all the testing was done there. But it always played incredibly well.
Well, if Darren's going to talk about this, I mean, when you were first on the show, Rob Burnett and I were so excited to meet you. Obviously, we talked about this because I used to work with you as a young teenager doing my fanzine, Galactic Journal, which then became a semi-professional magazine. But, Darren talks about seeing Star Trek III. That was the first Star Trek movie that I saw in a press all media screening, too, at the Lowe's State. And I remember that was a gorgeous theater and, I would like leave school early and take the subway into Manhattan. It was a big deal. It was like, I was really excited to go to Star Trek III. I mean, I had the highest expectations after Star Trek II. I'm just like, this is going to be amazing. And of course, you walk in and you're waiting online. And, it's a gorgeous theater. It was a duplex, unlike the Lowe's Astor Plaza, where Fox did like all the Star Wars screenings. But So, and I'm just like, and you go up these stairs and, you know, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful place. And he gave out the little cards with the cast, you know, with the key art on it, that awful key art. We'll talk about that. And I remember sitting there and unlike Darren, I immediately knew this movie was not good. But you know, I remember that screening like it was yesterday, 1984, 40 years ago.
I forgot about that card with the cast on it. I still have that somewhere.
Yeah, because then I went to all the, I mean, you know, to 4 and 5 and 6 and Generations. I mean, I think I've, you know, seen all of them, you know, in all medias or premieres or whatever. But that was the first of my Star Trek screenings. And it there was something so special about it back then, you know, those screenings. Because it wasn't all the media there is now. Like everyone in his parents' basement has a freaking website or a blog or something.
Yeah. Or a podcast.
You know, but so it was like really like you would be sitting there with the New York Times and the Daily News and, you know, all these outlets and in New York, it was all these.
We were treated specially.
You felt, but there was something special about it. Even if they didn't give you the free popcorn, it was still special. And now that's not so much the case anymore, but you get free popcorn. So, it, you know, it all evens out.
Yeah.
And back then, I could have used the free popcorn when I was a kid. So anyway, so we were talking about that key art that, because remember, it's not the Bob Peak key art that we love now.
It's the crystal face.
It was the color by numbers Spock, where you felt like, you know, those little things as a kid where you draw like, you'd trace it 1 to 2 to 3 and it would make an image.
The supermarket shopping bag.
Yeah, like on the supermarket shopping bag. That's what that key art always felt like to me. Can you tell us anything about
I remember what it was inspired by.
What?
Do you remember the scene in Superman?
The Jor-El crystal mask.
Yes.
Really?
The Jor-El crystal mask.
Wow.
That's the artist.
And crystal meth also was part of it. Wow.
But that was one of the I remember in a meeting, that was one of the pieces of scrap that was up. Like, how can we show
on
his face
board,
but not actually show Leonard's face?
And
that was one of the inspirations for that. I mean, it's terrible.
But it makes perfect sense.
But Star Trek 2 had a horrible poster.
Well, I was just going to say to you, because you told us about on Star Trek 2, we said, where'd that collage come from? That kindergarten collage, at, you know, because the Bob Peak art that was the international and then later on became is gorgeous. I mean, this is
beautiful.
And as it was for Star Trek 3. And you explained to us where that came from.
Yeah.
Which maybe you want to reiterate here for people.
The simple thing is they just wanted to denote this. A lot of stuff happens in this movie. You know, there's space.
We got battle, action and things exploding.
Explosions. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So they didn't care about showing the cast very much. So that was someone's idea. Someone paid a lot more money than I was.
It was awful. It was awful. And it was interesting because I remember on Star Trek 2, it was sneaked at least once or twice. I'm not talking about the test screen. I'm talking about literally it was sneak preview. They would show it a week before in theaters. And I remember, you know, creating some great word of mouth. Was Star Trek 2, 3, were there any sneak previews for Star Trek 3 or no?
I don't recall. I don't think so. Mm. Don't think so. We showed it to the press a lot, like the month prior. Mm. There was press junket and quite early actually, as I recall, like the first week of May, which was, you know, a sign of confidence.
Sure.
And then Leonard had to travel, I think, to some international territories. So,
and it still didn't play internationally. Like Star Trek never does.
No.
Because I think it made $76 million domestically. And then it maybe made another like 10 or 20 worldwide. It wasn't huge.
Yeah.
And you know, it's the curse of Star Trek. It just doesn't.
Well, and but back when the movies cost $16 million, it was
absolutely
worldwide.
Yeah. I mean, Star Trek III was a big financial success. Not as profitable as Star Trek II, but it was a big financial success.
Yeah.
All because of you, Eddie.
No doubt. Yeah. Yes.
Do you remember anything about sort of the lead up to the release and sort of your feelings and nerves and perhaps Leonard's concerns?
No, Leonard was feeling pretty good. I mean, he had been to all the test screenings, so he knew that it was working for an audience. You know, it's so funny, like, the Enterprise destruction thing made very little impact on people because there was a lot of speaking to groups of people after the screenings, and there wasn't a lot of focus on that.
Mm.
Yeah,
I wonder how much of it is recency bias, like in action, that the last thing as an audience member that you remember in that film is the reunion and everybody's happy and it's the success and it's victory and you go out on that. And when you're scoring it, when you're talking about the movie, that's the thing that is in your head.
You're right. The ending is so important to people. Yeah. Movies fail or rise. Yeah.
Yeah.
Harv talks about how he took that from a Helen Keller movie, how he was inspired by something that happens
in the Miracle Worker.
Yeah, and the
Miracle
Worker.
When she was brought back to life because she had her contract.
No, at the end where like she says something about.
Right, your name is, what's your name?
Yeah.
And she spells her name at the end.
Yeah, and he said that's where he got the idea for the ending. Your name is Jim.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it's so interesting because obviously Star Trek II couldn't get greenlit off of Harv's script. And it took Nick Meyer coming in to write, you know, what he wrote, which was, you know, terrific, virtually page one rewrite of, less than page one, but he did a really amazing rewrite of Jack Sauer.
It was Sowers a collage.
It was a pastiche of a bunch of drafts that he took and synthesized and made better.
Yeah.
So on Star Trek III, it's all Harv. And, I mean, we've seen various iterations of, you know, and he wrote it in 6 weeks, as opposed to like I think the 9 days or 13 days that Nick Meyer wrote, he could have used another 6 weeks.
Yeah.
It must have been hard for Leonard at that point to give too many notes because he was in a precarious position.
No. You're absolutely right. Yes, it was. He was very happy to have that job.
I mean, he was getting older. He was associated with Spock. He wasn't getting a ton of other work. And then this created, people forget, he was a hugely bankable A-list director because he didn't get 3 Men and a Baby off of Star Trek IV. He got it off Star Trek III because didn't they open about the same time?
No, he got it off of Star Trek IV.
He got it off Star Trek IV?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But and then, you know, he went on, and even though nothing did the business of Star Trek IV and 3 Men and a Baby, he did, you know, four or five big features afterwards.
Yeah.
And he only stopped getting hired after he got a reputation for being difficult and his movies didn't work. Yeah. I think he could have been difficult and he would have kept getting hired if his movies were successful if his, you know, he wasn't so difficult. I mean, because by the time you get to Holy Matrimony, I mean, him and Morgan Creek were like bitter.
Yeah. Well, Morgan Creek is no day at the beach to work with.
No. Yeah. But even Paramount, you know, with the funny about love was not a cakewalk.
Yeah. Was Holy Matrimony the Amish thing?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I told the story before, but I remember he did an adaptation with Liam Neeson of The Good Mother. And one of my college professors was Sue Miller, who wrote the book. And she was so sick of me. So what's going on with The Good Mother? How's that going? How do you like Leonard?
Liam Neeson and as The Good Mother?
It was like it was Diane Keaton. So it was like, and that was like his prestige Oscar bait movie.
Yeah.
So which didn't work at all.
Yeah.
But I was excited.
Material. Yeah,
it was tough. It was tough material. Yeah, that's for sure. So when you look back at Star Trek III, I mean, it really seems that shows. I mean, you did what you needed to do. I mean, the movie opened. It was perceived well. There was no negativity. There were, you know, there were no bad rumors coming out of production. Yeah. It really was a successful publicity campaign, wasn't it?
All things considered, yes. Yeah.
And I mean, like, you don't make the movie. It's your job to sell the movie,
no,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, yep. You can't be blamed for whatever doesn't work about it. And meanwhile, I guess we're kind of in the minority. You heard, you know, Terry Metalis and Kevin Feige and Steve Asbell, you know, talking about how much they love Star Trek III. So, yeah. I mean, you know, it's very polarizing. Whenever we do these episodes, there are people that love it and there are people that totally get what we're saying. And there are a lot of people who loved it but then get what we're saying and don't love it as much.
Yeah, and by the way, I hope I'm not shitting on it too much. I think there are some really effective scenes in
the
movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's mostly just the way it looks and the indifference seemingly to modulating people's performances or fine-tuning dialogue.
The ingredients are great. The recipe is just a little wrong.
Right. Well, what's the expression? You know, the definition of a great film is a few great scenes and no bad ones. Well, there are a few great scenes in Star Trek III.
Yeah.
That's true.
And then
that's a really good point. That's a really good point. And, you know, they say about directors also, you know, a lot of directors are either an actor's director and then their DP is sort of responsible for the look of the film, or they're totally obsessed with the look of the film and not really actor's directors. Leonard, you know, became an actor's director, but I don't think he was ever that focused on the visuals. I mean, certainly in this case, it seemed like he was deferring a lot to Don Peterman. Or the fact that he'd only
TV. Was Charles Carell.
I mean, Charles Carell, the great Charles Carell.
He wished he had Don Peterman.
Don Peterman was on Star Trek IV. Yeah. Now, and Charles Carell was an amazing DP, but it was very late in his career. And, you know, also he didn't have a lot of money. And that set, I don't think, you know, Vilmos Zsigmond could have made that set look good. you know, it's just Vittorio Storaro couldn't make that set look good.
Well, he would have made it dark.
Right. That's true.
Have made it look better.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That's a really good point. I you know, you hear these stories about how they wanted to go to Hawaii to shoot and they just didn't have the money and they made the decision that it was better to control the sets by building them in like the old show.
I think they made the right decision, though. I don't think Hawaii would have saved.
By the way, there were also discussions about how the main cast would look in daylight. I mean, no disrespect.
Sure. Oh, they were all in their mid-50s.
Yes. So it was that was also like, I remember some input from the feature film division about, we're not sure they should be out in broad daylight in Hawaii, you know, so.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
And I know they were concerned about how they would do all the pyro gags in Hawaii and the planet self-destructing.
No, that's a huge problem on stage, let alone not out on location. They would not have been able to pull that off.
Yeah.
But I think it would be a much better looking, it'd be a much better looking movie.
But again, I don't think they had the wherewithal to, if they had done some location shooting, integrating it with the stage stuff would have been like
nightmare.
That takes an enormous amount of expertise, as you guys know.
Maybe they could have found a producer like, I don't know, what's his name? Rhymes with Salen, Bob Salen.
I don't want to get into Star Trek IV because I think, you know, this is a great look back at Star Trek III. But I just want to talk about it. Like, what point after Star Trek III did you start to hear rumblings about we got to do another movie?
Right away. Mm-hmm. And then it just went through all those, you know, permutations about Eddie Murphy and a whole, and then that delayed it. But it was. It, right away, but it was graduated into the actual Paramount Pictures group instead of the television group.
Did you work on Golden Child also or no?
Yes.
You did. Oh man, yes. that's a whole episode, I bet. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, yes, I did.
Boy, that was a time where Paramount could do no wrong, and then they did wrong. Although it did.
Yeah.
It did.
But it was just an incredibly varied bunch of movies. I mean, they had like a shooting on that lot. I mean, The Golden Child, Clue, just a whole and a whole lot of losers too. I mean, has anyone ever heard of the Whoopi Boys?
No.
No.
Okay. But there was also, you know, this is the era of Footloose and Flashdance.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. It's like 1985 was not a good year for Paramount. Yeah. Mm.
But 84 was a pretty good year because they also had Temple of Doom.
Yes.
Yeah. Which was big.
And even though, by the way, you mentioned the Lowe's Astor Plaza, you know, that all media screening was at, for Temple of Doom was at the Lowe's Astor Plaza, and a man got up during the grabbing the heart scene,
yeah,
and face planted in the aisle.
Really?
Wow. Yeah.
I think I was there. I'm pretty sure I went
was,
to Doom.
Yeah, there was.
Were you that
was
man?
Very. No, yeah, it was the all media. Man. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he fainted.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Boy, somebody like William Castle would have made hay of that. I'm sure he kind of wanted to bury that story.
Yeah.
that's wild. But that was a great year for Paramount.
I mean,
people, there's all this critical revisionism about Doom now, but at the time, you know, other than the people thought it was too violent, people really loved it.
Yeah.
So, well, Eddie, it's always such a pleasure to have you on the show and such a font of information. And I love when we do these Trek archaeology shows because we always learn something new. And I know the audience will, but even the Trek experts, there's so much we don't know. So we're grateful. And it's just wonderful because today you see so many of these people that work on Star Trek that don't care. They're not invested in it. It's just a job. And for you, it was always a passion, and it, you know, that comes across that, I mean, here you are all these years later talking about this and you still have this immense enthusiasm and passion, you know, for these projects you worked on. And I have so much admiration.
We like that.
We do. We really do. So
especially the bombshell about Barry Manilow being the first choice for crew.
No, who was the first? There was somebody really interesting that was the first choice for Krug, and then it became. I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, I mean,
Robert Mitchum.
No. I remember DeForest Kelly. I think I told this to you, Mark, on a phone call. I think once. Huh. DeForest Kelly was the nicest man on earth, and he was. He had the impression that they were going to pepper the movie with these great actors, and he started to name some people who he thought would be good for the James Sicking part or the Grissom captain, right. and he was so disappointed that when he saw who was cast in those roles, because he, you know, he didn't interact. He's only with Shatner he's not with Shatner in some of those other scenes, and certainly not on the other spaceships. But I remember he was there was some discussion about the actor Robert Weber. Mm-hmm. Do you know who Robert Weber
yeah,
is?
Yeah.
Playing Styles. No, playing the Robert Hooks part.
Oh, he would have been good.
Yeah. So these little, and then there was a guy, and this was a Leonard thing. Jeff Corey was he?
Of
sure.
course, he put him in everything. He was his teacher at the Actor Studio. When yes, Blacklist appears. He was in the Cloudminders. Yeah,
he had him in mind for some role also. But again,
Dame Judith Anderson.
It came
not
down
for a part. He was going to play Dame Judith.
Yeah, it came down to, you know, money and you know, whether Paramount Television had dibs on another part for some of these people, like the kid who played Mr. Adventure.
Adventure, right?
Yeah, he was a he had a deal. Like a lot of those people had deals with, and Greg Morris's son, who's on the ship. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a lot of those
people liked Mr. Adventure. I felt like, you know.
Well, just because you almost look exactly like him.
Well, yeah, that's probably a sweet narcissism, but
I know we were letting you go, but I got to ask you one more thing that came up. I'm so sorry. This is the last, I promise, last question, but this was really the first of the movies that services the, what Shatner once called the Seven Dwarfs, the supporting cast.
Yeah.
And they got Yeah, but they got a lot more to do than ever before. So was that reflected at all in your publicity, or do you remember their feelings? Like, obviously, George gets some great scenes. You know, Walter, despite the collar, he had done more in Star Trek II. But, you know, Nichelle gets some great moments. Jimmy, you know, has great moments.
Only in the sense that I think Leonard would always talk about this isn't, you know, it isn't just about Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. It's about a group of people with varying skills and various ways of attacking problems, working together. Mm. Like, so he would reference them in that way. But no, it didn't. I mean, we tried to make sure by releasing certain photos that, you know, suggested, like, the shot of Uhura with the phaser was a big deal. Like, ooh, right. Wait, you didn't see who she was aiming it at.
Right, sure. Ashley Miller.
They were just to suggest a larger scope and some action. So,
yeah. You see, Eddie, it's all about a family.
Well, Eddie, thank you again. This has been great. And we'll have to have you back to talk about the anniversary of Star Trek IV. When that comes around, because I know you have great stories about the voyage home, which was your final brush with Trekdom.
My final voyage. Yeah.
Your final voyage. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, until then, this has been great. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you guys. Thank you, Ashley.
Thanks, Eddie.
Thank you, Mark.
Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy. Woo! And sadness. Oh. And anger. Definitely some disgust.
Rose!
And I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Well, we're back, and I hope you don't feel that we sold you a bill of goods, because that was a great episode.
How fun was that? I totally always fun. Love when any visits us.
Yeah, yeah. I said it a couple of times, but, you know, if you've ever had to deal with studio publicists, most of them are assholes.
Yeah.
And most of them really don't care about what they're working on. Eddie is such a breath of fresh air because he genuinely loves this stuff. And not only does he love it, he remembers it like it was yesterday. And every time he kind of drops these like little nuggets of information, like it's nothing. And we're like, what? No way. Is that true? And it's, well, you'll hear it when you listen to, you know, how you heard it during the conversation we just had. So it's pretty cool. And we'd like to do more with Eddie in the future. So stay tuned for that. We're going to be making some exciting announcements here on the Trekspritz very soon about some of the things we have coming up this year. And I hope you'll stick around for that. We're going to be announcing some appearances. We're going to be announcing some new podcasts. we're going to be announcing. Hopefully, we can announce that we're working and we're done with this.
Yeah. And we're out of this business.
And afterwards, stay tuned. There's more to tell.
Exactly. So if you enjoyed this episode, I hope you'll consider rating us 5 stars wherever you listen to the podcast and follow us or subscribe by clicking that button. And of course, if you want even more of the three of us plus Steve Melching, you can listen to Deck 78 and that can be subscribed to at TrekSportsPlus.com. Or if you prefer to listen to it on Apple Podcasts, you can subscribe to the 4:30 movie feed on Apple Podcasts. And 4:30 Movie, of course, is our sister podcast in which we create fantasy theme weeks of classic films. You don't want to miss that. We're in the middle of our 7th season. It's been just terrific. And also, don't miss us, if you can, at Ticonderoga later this month, or in Oklahoma City for another great GalaxyCon. GalaxyCon.com is where you can find all the guests and information. Hopefully there will not be a twister. There have been a lot of bad weather in Oklahoma lately. I'm not thrilled about that, but I'm going anyway. Twister, Auntie M.
Twister. I don't even know her.
But I'm excited. There's gonna be some great guests, and it's gonna be a great. It's gonna be a great show. The Galaxy Cons always are phenomenal, and if you're anywhere near Oklahoma City, you owe it to yourself to take a trek down there and join us. And of course, we're delighted to be going to Ticonderoga, and we'll share all the gory details when we return. Of our trip to the Star Trek tour and Trek Conderoga with some really special guests. So that's exciting as well. Otherwise, please check us out on our new Discord channel where you can join the conversation live every day on Discord. And the details for that are in the show notes. Or you can engage with us through social on all your favorite social channels at Inglourious Trek and Glorious Trexperts. So on behalf of Derek Doctorman, Ashley Edward Miller, myself, Mark A. Altman, keep on trekking, ingloriously, of course. Hey, Darren, is this rumor going around that you got a new podcast?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's Trekspert's adjacent. It's a fun thing. It's called the Weirded Beardos. Yeah, and before you react, it's Kirk Thatcher, our favorite punk on the bus, and myself just talking about stuff.
But I hate him.
You don't hate him.
No, I'm kidding. I'm doing a song from Star Trek 4. I hate you, right?
I berate you.
Oh, yeah. But I don't berate him, and I don't hate him. And if he's involved with you, then I love you.
Well, thanks. And, you know, it's basically just us talking about sort of all things related to our history of working in the industry. You know, together we have like 78 years of experience working in the entertainment biz.
I'm going to have to listen to that. I thought it was about maintaining your beards or something.
It has nothing to do with beards, actually, which is kind of funny. But it's fun. We basically hang out for an hour every other week. So come and join us. Look for the Weirded Beardos on Spotify if you just want to hear the audio. And we're actually on YouTube as well, the Weirded Beardos.
Great. Can't wait to check it out.
Thanks.
First, start to the right and straight on till morning.